Let's learn. This evening we're learning about the topic of it's Maamar Lamed Aleph in Sichas Mus. It's the only Maamar he has from the year Tafshin Lamed Aleph, which is 1971 in Mir Yeshiva, and the topic is Yesh Koila Olamo Bashar Achas, which means that a person can acquire their world in one moment. Some famous stories, some less famous stories, and try to investigate this. And it sounds like the ideas we've discovered, but the way he marvelously flips them into the responsibility that moments, defining moments, have is remarkable. So let's try to unpack this again. I apologize, there's no text, so I'm going to just focus on the basic principles. This exposure tells us in the beginning of Parshas Vayera that it says there's like a very unusual thing that happens. So Moshe and Aaron are sent to Pharaoh, and Hashem, and they're told the following: "Vayetzavim es b'nei Yisrael v'alparo melech Mitzrayim lo hitzi es b'nei Yisrael meretz Mitzrayim." So they're told to go to Pharaoh, to go to the children of Israel, to go to Pharaoh. And Yerushalmi, commenting on this, says a very strange thing. The Yerushalmi is in Rosh Hashanah Perek Gimel Halacha Hey. It says, "Amar b'Shmuel bar Yisok al matzivim." So what was that he commanded them? So you'd think, you know, Exodus, freedom. Determination, that's the word. Everybody is entitled to a narrative of self-determination. Well, what do they command them? So the Mirushami says, Al Parshas Shiluach Avodim. The Alochas of Shiluach Avodim. What's the Alochas of Shiluach Avodim? Is if you have a Hebrew bondsman, you have a fellow Jew who's your bondsman, that at the time that a Shemitah comes, you have to set them free. That's the Alochas they learned. Really? I mean, like that's what they need to hear right now. First of all, let's appreciate this. First of all, they are slaves. So it's not like, you know what I'm saying? It's not that they have the liberty of having slaves, number one. It's not no gear. But never mind, never that. It's not even not going to be no gear in the desert, right? When they enter the land of Eretz Israel, it's so far flying. You know, Moshe Rabbeinu is going to say, folks, town hall meeting about the issues that we have at hand. And he's going to start talking about Shiluach Havarim. They're Havarim. The whole thing is just so... so far-fetched. What is the Yerushalmi inserting over here? And in fact, Yirmiyahu in Perek Lamed Daled, it's a remarkable story. He doesn't quote the context, which is just remarkable. And to me, this is really phenomenal because we just commemorated Asarah B'Teves. And I think most people forget what Asarah B'Teves is about. The way it worked at the end of the first base of Mikdash was the following. As Bavel was rising as a power, the Babylonian Empire was taking over country after country after country. What happened was is that a few of the smaller countries banded together. So Ammon, Judea, Yehuda, Mitzrayim, sort of banded together in an alliance against the Babylonians, against the will of Yirmiyahu. Yirmiyahu said, Hashem doesn't want you to fight against them. Be passive, pay their taxes, don't fight, you don't know zchuyos. That's what happened. And Tzidkiyahu, Yoyakim disagreed, Yoyachin disagreed and was sent into Golus, and Tzidkiyahu, the last king, also, may formed an alliance at a summit in Egypt, and they made this pact against Bavel. So Bavel meant business, and they sent Nebuchadnezzar came along and besieged Jerusalem. And there were two sieges of Jerusalem, one in the eighth year of Tzidkiyahu and one a little bit later. The what happens is a siege settles on Jerusalem. And when it is a siege, of course, you're short of food, basic amenities, and the barons, the aristocracy of Yerushalayim, were concerned about the following case. You know, what happens is you know, if there's only so many loaves of bread, well, who's getting them? It's obviously the aristocracy, right? The problem is what about the slaves who live in the basement who serve you? So they're probably not going to be getting so much. So if that's the case, what's going to happen is you have a threat of a fifth leg. You have a threat of an internal rebellion because what's to stop these folks from joining the enemy? Because ultimately, they're the lowest rung of Jerusalem society. So what do? They had a great idea. So they freed all their slaves because they said, let's throw them a bone so they'll remain on our side and they can fight against the Babylonians. And so on the one hand, you know, it's a laudable fact. It's great, meaning to say they hadn't been sending forth their slaves. One of the problems in society in those days was that the lords and the overlords were taking advantage of the poor and the weak. There was no transparency, there was no accountability. So this was a great move. Problem is what happens is that Egypt, who was Israel's ally at the time, attacked the port of Ashkelon. So you can imagine the ships coming off the Egyptian coast, attacking the port of Ashkelon. The Babylonians hear about this, and they lift the siege in Jerusalem to go attack the Egyptians. They think this is amazing. Eri starts dancing on the rooftops, and what do? They re-incarcerate all their slaves. That's how fickle they were. That's how verkrumped society was at the time. They reincarcerate their slaves. They believe this is like Sancheriv leaving Yerushalayim at the times of Chizkiyahu HaMelech. They think we're done. And then when the Egyptians back off, that's when the real siege starts. And that lasts 2.5 years, and that's when Jerusalem is destroyed. So I believe Asara Batavius is also commemorating our own stupidity, meaning our own inability to be able to see what Hashem is said or talking about, and when he means business, that we think that we can play games, right? So I think there's something more in that if you read these narratives. So in that perek, in perek Lamed Daled, Yirmiyahu is talking to these people, and he's saying to the bondsmen of Yerushalayim, and listen to what he says. Yirmiyahu says, "Komar Hashem Elokei Yisrael, Anochi Karati Bris Savoseichem B'Yoyim Atziyo Esamaretz Yisrael. I made a covenant with your ancestors when they left Egypt. Mibeis Avodim, Miketz Sheva Shonim Chasa Tishlachu Esh Yisachiv Ha'ivri. You need to send out your bondsmen. Meaning, and you now are forfeiting that by taking back your slaves. You are reneging on your freedom because that was the tnai of your freedom." So again, Yirmiyahu is going back, and in fact, Yerushalmi goes so far as to say that same Yerushalmi that Rav Hillel would say, "Lo ne'enshu Yisrael elo al parashas Shiloach Avodim." In fact, the Golus was as a result of Shiloach Avodim. That's very heavy. I mean, like, there was bad things going on. There was Avodah Zorah, there was alliances, there was distrust in Hashem, there was all kinds of bad things going on in that time. There was abuse, there was adultery, there was murder, there was all kinds of terrible things going on in society at the time. Why? What was the big thing? Is Shiloach Avodim, Yirmiyahu Perek Lamed Daled. Like, you know, again, it seems so seminal. It seems to be, what is the town hall meeting about? Is Shiloach Avodim. Why they sent to the Golos? Shiloach Avodim. Okay, that's important. You know, like, you know, but, you know, in the grander scheme of things, is that so important? That's his Shiloh. So from two perspectives. First, we see how Golos comes, and also how the Geula came seems to be focused around this. That's his Shiloh. And he says, look, you want to tell me, okay, it's an important thing to be Mechazek, but let's be honest. Isn't it interesting? The first thing after Matan Torah, you know, after we have a few like addendums to Aseres and Dibros, what's the first thing? Parshas Mishpatim, Mal Mishpatim, Shatazim Lifnayim. Evet Ivri again. There it is. You know, like, what is going on with Evet Ivri? Like, you know, that's kind of like that's Appendix 3, you know, to Judaism. That's not like the first thing you tell, you know, when you tell somebody who's interested in Judaism, tell them what Judaism's about. Well, if you have a slave, right, that's not how it works. So here's his thesis. His thesis is that it's a little hard for us to appreciate today because we don't own people, we don't have bondsmen necessarily. But if you think about it, in those days, you know, if you had essentially a person could be in a certain sense an investment or an asset. If you think about that, you have somebody who's an investment and they're worth money, and oftentimes a bondsman, a Hebrew bondsman, not a slave, the Hebrew bondsman would be as a function of either stealing money or whatever, they're paying back a debt, right? So they're worth it. They're a financial investment. People don't like parting with financial investments. They really don't. Anybody who tries fundraising, even for the best of causes, is very difficult. People don't like to part with things, and people will argue dollars and cents about anything, right? So it says here what the Torah is saying is, here you have a financial investment, and the Torah is saying is there's a limit. There's a statute of limitations. It's not going to work after 7 years. By the way, you could buy your slave 1 year before Shemitah, and that's it. Obviously, the price will be lower because the amount of time invested is less. But at the same time, you're like, so people say, does anybody really notice? Does anybody really notice if I just, you know, keep them on? I'll give them a nice suite. I'll give them, like, you know, a two-bedroom shack in the backyard, right? Like, does anybody really notice? So Rav Chaim Shlomo says, is that this is a great financial sacrifice that people are making to let go of something which is financially viable for themselves. So why does the Torah expect us to do this? The Torah tells us that most valuable moment in our lives, when we were there in Egypt and we felt what it was like to be bondsmen to somebody else, that's when Moshe says, I want you to, as you feel it now, when you feel like you have no schedule, you never have a life, you're not able to spend time with the family and the kids, when you're in this situation, understand that I'm going to use this moment for you to be able to appreciate what it means to do this in the future. Meaning that in a certain sense, the reason why this is so important is not so much per se because of the actual halachas of freeing slaves. It's about the ability to appreciate, the moment, right? If you can't appreciate that moment, then you've lost something of your sensitivity to the situation you're experiencing. That's the problem. You cannot miss out something in life, experience something which was supposed to teach you a lesson, right? So his way of saying it is, according in Shmos Perek Chof Gimel, which is in Parshas Mishpatim, V'atem yadatem es nefesh ha-ger ki gerim ha-yisim eretz Mitzrayim. You're supposed to have learned something from Egypt. If you didn't, you clearly did not take the course. Right? You were here for a reason. If you didn't get that moment, you lost it. So this is a fascinating argument. What he is saying is that the halachas aren't necessarily, it isn't because this halacha is more important than the halachas. It's this experience was wasted. It was squandered on you. If it's squandered on you, then maybe you need to experience it again. Maybe you need to go through that course again. So let's go through Golas again to get you the appreciation of the value of people's time, the value of people's money, the value of freedom. That's what that was always missing. So Racham Shlomo is like, now tries to pry this open. So he says, okay, let's take this idea and let's expand this idea, what he calls the responsibility of experience. So if we go through something, everything we go through is a responsibility for us to have taken something from it. Should we squander that, then we missed the opportunity. We missed that experience. We didn't live in that experience. We passed it by. We may have to go through it again as a retraining. So that's his example. So now he gives a few specific case in points. One case is a very famous case where he quotes the Gemara in Sanhedrin, New Testament Beis. It says, the Gemara says the following, Tokfo shel Boaz v'anavanusosoi shel palti b'linyash. It talks about the strength of Boaz and the humility of Palti ben Laish. Who is Palti ben Laish? So the Gemara continues to say, quoting the pasuk in Mishlei, Rabos bonos oiso chayil. We sing this every Friday night. Many daughters did chayil, like did strength and valor. This is referring to Zeh Yosef. Why was Yosef so expressed valor? Because he was in a very very difficult moral predicament. There's Ashes Potiphar, nobody else is around. Is his moral system really supposed to be held up to this level? But Va'atal Yisrael Kolano, the one who ascended above Yosef was Palti ben Laish. What happens? Shenosan lo Shaul es bito le'isha. What happens? Is Michal is married to David HaMelech. David HaMelech is wanted man number one in the kingdom of Israel, and he's kicked out. Michal actually saves David. And in almost as a punishment, as a jab back at David, he remarries his daughter Michal to this fellow called Palti ben Laish. So the Gemara says, "V'loy korav eleosh shanim rabos b'yodosh niskach l'David." But he never had an intimate relationship with her because he knew that she was really married to David HaMelech. And the Gemara goes on to say that why was his name Palti? He says, "Paltiel shepoltu kel min avera." Hashem, sort of the word palat means to be pushed out. Right, yeah. Plata, Yesheris a plata, or plata in terms of Yoredea, we talk about when a pot is, poilated, it expresses outwards. He was rejected or ejected from the Avera, from Hashem. Why? Ma'asa, what did he do? Na'atzcherov be'na leveno. And he said the first night he came home, after being, we'll call it, the federal government marriage, we'll call it, you know. So he's been reappropriated to be married to her. He sticks a sword in the bed between the two of them. Omar kol oisik bedavarze yidake becherev. He says anybody who crosses the sword, meaning me or she, should be killed by a sword because we're not entitled to each other. And for years he stayed that way. And the Gemara goes on to say, much stronger than Yosef. Why? Because Yosef had one moment. Listen, obviously this lady was a tough nut, and she was making a lot of advances, and it was difficult for Yosef. But ultimately, there was one pinnacle moment. Yosef managed to run outside. But here we go, in the privacy of the home, there's no undertaker, there's no big brother cameras on the wall, and, you know, he has to be remarried to her. Who would really know? You think David's going to survive the nationwide search with the money on his name? David HaMelech ran to Eretz Plishtim. For all we know, David HaMelech is never going to return. But Palti ben Laish had his moral scruples, and he was able to do this. Unbelievable, Gemara says. Even more, nobody was able to do what Palti ben Laish did. So he says, what schus did he have? I mean, this is superhuman in a certain sense. What he was able to achieve? How did he do that? How was he zoicha to be polite niflat ben avera? So he says, because why? He had a moment of realization this was incorrect, and what he did was he capitalized on that moment. He knew the first night he came back, he knew this is inappropriate, and he saw that, three years down the line, while they're going to be watching Netflix together, he understood what happens. We're going to go out to the movies, right, and we get friendly, and we play board games together, we go out to eat together. He says, no, we're not going to have any of this. He says, and this moment of realization of what is correct, I'm going to now capitalize on that. I'm going to create a barrier. And it's going to remind us at all times what is correct, what is not correct. Because, they say I had a Rebbe in Kerem Yavne, whose name is Rav Moshe Stav, and he used to say that sailors, you can only set your compass on dry land. When you go out to sea, you can't set the compass. You know, compasses need adjusting. You can't set the compass at sea, because at sea, everything's moving. Right, so he knew, I'm on dry land, I'm about to get out to sea. The only way you can set the compass is right now. where I know what the clarity is, I see objectively what's going on, and I capitalize in that moment. That was what Parthi Vinayash did. Another example he gives, phenomenal example, is he says, in Parshas Noach, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, Vayah ba'anani anan, when there's going to be this cloud on the earth, Allah Oretz, right, what he says, and Rashi explains, Keshetale b'machshava lefonai lehavi hocheshech v'avodah ala oilam, that v'niras ha'kesh is banan, v'zacharti is brisi asher ben yu v'nechem. What am I going to do? I'm going to look at the rainbow, and I'm going to see it. Like, Hashem needs reminding, you know, like a little post-it. You're like, oh, yes, I was about to pull the plug again, but you know, there's the rainbow. What does that mean? Right? So he says, no. He says, of course, like the Kodesh Baruch Hu doesn't need a reminder. The point is, he's showing the human psyche, it is possible to remember decisions made, even despite the drama of the moment. Look what you're doing again. You're doing it again, humanity. You're killing each other. You're immoral. You're destroying yourselves. There's another world war just 20 years after the first one. Like, can't you get yourselves together, humanity? And Kodesh Baruch Hu says, you know what? I know this. I want you to know that I know this. I want you to know that it's possible to remember moments of clarity amongst the darkness when things don't look right and you see what people acting in such ways. So it's a reflected moment on us. So again, the idea is what he's doing is he's saying that experiences lend us moments of clarity. We need to use those moments of clarity. If we don't, we've missed the boat. Just interesting. I remember this is a fascinating story. They say about there's a fellow who's, you know, had big life decisions to make, and he's been on the one hand, he's going to school because his parents said, you know, it's time he should go. You know, he's doing accounting and he's getting the career together. But he has his love for music. He's been playing violin since the age of 4 years old, and he's going and going and going, and he just doesn't know where he's, like, sort of at a crossroads, because, you know, his heart really tells him he wants to go into music, but his parents are telling him it's not sustainable. You're going to get married, how are you going to support the family? You know what you're going to give, you know, violin lessons is not so simple. You know, clientele, it's not easy, right? So he's at the real crossroads. He's in Central Park. He's walking along, and there he is walking along. He sees on the bench one of the greatest virtuosos, one of the greatest violin players in the world. And he knows exactly, that's unbelievable, must have taken a break from Carnegie Hall, you know, on one of the performances. He says to him, you know, would you mind? I have this big decision to make in life, and I just don't know if I have it in me to go. So he said, you know, go ahead, why don't you play a piece? So he starts playing, plays a, you know, very complex piece, and the man closes his eyes and listens very carefully. At the end of it, the man opens up his eyes and he just shakes his head and says, you don't have it inside you. So, you know, it's a crushing feeling. I mean, we're talking about, you know, almost 2 decades of training. But nonetheless, okay, at least there's clarity. You know, he's got, from the Rashka Bahag, right? You know, he's got, the Sotari Misinai. So he puts the violin back in the case, he puts it on the top of his closet, and that's it. He goes back, he gets his degree, he starts working, and he's actually very successful. He goes into public accounting, goes into a private firm, and he's you know, very, very successful. Many years later, he's walking through Central Park, and boom, on the same bench, there's the man, 10 years later. Right now, he's got a wife, kids, everything's fine, everything's all right, and he says, I want to tell you something, I so appreciate, you know, that you gave me that clarity, that moment in life, you gave me that moment. So the man smiles at him, he says, I tell that to all of them. He says, only the ones who really believe in it actually don't disagree with me. Meaning, like to say, like, you know, this, right? We miss those moments. Are you, do you really believe? Do you really know, right? Or no? With life, you'll just sink back into reality. Complexity, not so simple. Gives another two fascinating examples. I came across this one example recently because it's such one of the most astounding midrashim I've ever come across. It's a midrash in Bereshis Rabbah in Sof Perek Samachay in Bereshis Rabbah, and it's a story about a person whose name is Yakum. Yakum is actually, let me just get the Yakum Ish Tzororos. He was the nephew of Yosef and Yoezer. So let's just put this in perspective. If you go through the first Perek of Perek Avos, what happens is a source of Anshe Knesset HaGdolah, the man of the Great Assembly, at the beginning of the second bias. The Shirei Anshe Knesset HaGdolah is Shimon HaTzadik. From him, we have Antigonos Ish Soichoi, and then we have, after that, we have 5 sets of pairs. Right. Those are called the Zugos. Each of those pairs are the co-leaders of the generation, the Nasi and the Avbeistin. Right? So it goes all the way through. The first set is Yosef ben Yoezer and Yosef Yosef ben Yerushalayim. I can't remember the name. I always get mixed up between the two Yosefs. One is from Sereda, one is from Yerushalayim, and those are the Avbeistin and the and the Nasi. One of the things which is lesser known is sort of matching up the historical time period with who they are and where they live. Happens to be that they are living at the times of Hellenization, right? So they're living at the time when the Greeks are in control, but not only the Greeks in control, the Jews, who are very akin to Hellenization, are taking control. And at this point in time, we know that there's a few stages of the Greek or the Hellenized Jews and the wars. Thank you so much. So it is Yosef and Yoezer and Ish-Sred and Yosef and Yochanan. Thank you. Ish-Yerushalayim. Okay? So you have these two leaders. By the way, if you read their statements and what they're based on, they have two different philosophies in how to deal with Greek culture. Fascinating to read into the Mishnah what they really are saying about how to deal with outside culture. But nonetheless, so this is a time when, just to appreciate, there was a few stages of Greek control. First, there was a fellow called Melanus, who was who took the coin Godel ship from the Jews, and that was when Mattathias and his sons fought the battle and rejected them. This is when Antiochus IV sort of backed off. But then there's another fellow called Demetrius who took over after Antiochus. There was many stages, and he, two years later, reapplied all the anti-religious laws in this particular area. And one of the leaders of the time was a man whose name was Yakum. Yakum was the nephew of the leader of the generation. He was a Hellenized Jew, the nephew of Yosef ben Yoezer, right? That's shocking. I mean, so can you imagine? This is the figurehead of Jewry. His nephew is a Hellenized Jew, who's one of the leaders of the opposition movement. In fact, the Gemara actually in other places talks about how Yosef ben Yoezer actually disinherited his own son. I mean, you have to imagine how difficult a time it was. We're talking about Hellenization. But nonetheless, this is his nephew. So what happens is Yosef ben Yoezer was accused of practicing religion, and he was being taken out to be killed, most probably and ostensibly by the evidence of his own nephew. Okay, can you imagine this? So here, and they cross paths. So he is carrying, whether it be the crucifix or the pole that he's going to be taken out to be hanged upon. And on Shabbos, this fellow Yakum, I can't remember his Greek name, I think it was an A, Alamus was his name, and he's walking past him on a horse on Shabbos, and this is the comment he makes. Listen to this, shocking. Omer le Yakum le Rabbi Yosef, Ra'a susi da'arkave bay mori, v'ra'a suscho da'arkave morach, da'arkavar morach. Look at the horses that we ride upon. Meaning, what are you doing? You're carrying a pole that you're going to be hanged upon because that was what you trusted. You trusted your Judaism. Look what's going to happen to you. Look at the horse I ride on. Look at the powers I trusted in. Who's coming out on top? Right? Shocking. This is his nephew. Omalei, so responds Rabbi Yosef ben Yoezer, im lemachi sov kach, if this is the way that those who anger him are treated, meaning you think you're getting reward. Wait until HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives reward. You're the one Hashem is angry about. Wait until the reward for those HaKadosh Baruch Hu really rewards. And if I'm being killed and I'm somebody who's oisei ritzona, who lives Hashem's will, oh boy, you have got a warm surprise waiting for you, son. Well, at the end of the day, right? That's Rabbi Yosef ben Yoezer said. His last comment. So apparently, this comment really hit him. Yakum was very affected by this. Nichnas boy adava keeres shel achnai. So this like it was like a poison in the serpent. He couldn't stop thinking about this. Halach v'kiyem ba'atzmo dalad Mrs. Beistin nisnam name Rabbi Yosef ben Yoezer ra mitosa parachas ba'avir omer b'shar kalod kadmani zela gan Eden. What happens? It's pretty gruesome. It describes how Yaakov was so affected by this, he set up a pole, he hung himself on the pole, which was above fire, and a pile of rocks, in a way that when the fire burnt him and the rope, he fell and was hit by the sword, and the rocks fell upon him, so he was Makayim, the Dalad Mrs. Basin, and he was strangled, and he was burnt, and he was like, or it's meaning to say he self-imposed the Dalad Mistos upon himself because he was so taken by Rabbi Yosef ben Yoezer. And that's when Rabbi Yosef ben Yoezer saw this. And by the way, Rabbi Yosef ben Yoezer still died. And it wasn't like he didn't have the magic wand to change this. But Yosef ben Yoezer, before he died, when he saw this happen, he said, I saw his bed floating in the air. I know that he is going to be Mechitzasi. Crazy, 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 right? So what will you see over here is that means to say that you have a person who used it. That was his moment. And he could have easily dismissed that and that would have been it. You know, goodbye, and I lived a happy life as a well-informed Greek Hellenizer. But nonetheless, that was what he did. Now, more famously, we know the other story. There's one in Yerushalayim, design actually, in Avodah Zarah, a famous story, but with a twist. And that is, there's a story about this fellow called Elazar ben Dodai. He was a famous man. He committed all the sins in the world. So the Gemara goes so far as to say that Loyin is, you know, there was not a woman of the night that he did not frequent. So he was, you know, very, very involved in Olam Hazeh. And what happens is that, you know, he consorts with a particular lady of ill repute. He comes into her bedroom and she releases gas, and she says that just like the gas can't return to the body, so to Elazar ben Dodai will never be able to return. And he was so shocked. That statement was so shocking to him that, like, sort of he was so lost. He immediately wanted to go on the tshuva process. So famously, he says, he goes out and he starts crying, and he turns to the mountains, and he says, mountains, you know, mountains and valleys, harim v'gvois, give me tshuva. And they say, no, we're praying for ourselves. He turns to the shemayim v'aretz, and he says, please give me tshuva. And they said, no, the shemesh v'yarech, and they give him tshuva. And finally, he says, famously, he put his head between his knees, and he says, ana dovar tolo elabi. He cried to the point that he cried in anguish and such regret that he dies. And there's a bas kol which says that comes out and says, Rebbe Elazar ben Dodai muzuman l'chaye ha'olam haba. And Rebbe would say, Yesh kone olam habashal echas, and then some people can acquire the world in one moment. So first of all, by the way, does this work? And the answer is, of course it works. Should one do this? Well, you might say, like, you know, technically speaking, it does work, but nobody exactly knows, you know, the timeline. And nobody knows if they're going to be able to do this. And besides, you missed the opportunities. But nonetheless,
it is the value of 1 hour,
right,
as opposed to a whole lifetime.
Right. So he had a messed up life. And so, I mean, but it's interesting. Just, you know, so, you know, this is not to be tried at home. But nonetheless, it is an amazing experience. So just one quick horror in this, which is by J.J. Schachter pointed out, is that if you look at these the we'll call the entities he turns to. He turns to each entity, so it's the Harim V'Gvois, the mountains and the valleys. It could actually be in Hoirim, his parents. And he says, you know what? You know why I'm like I am? You know why I'm so morally corrupt? It's my parents. They didn't have any internet filters, right? They allowed me, they exposed me when I was at a young age. And, you know, that's why I am who I am. So he said, don't blame us. We've got enough to talk about ourselves. So he says, no. Shomayim v'aretz. He says, environmentalism. It was my school. It was where I was. You know, it wasn't, it was, that was what made me who I am. They said, don't talk about us. It's you. And then he said, Shemesh v'yarech. No, it's the star signs. It was how I was born. It was my makeup. It was my psychological makeup. That's who I am. I was born under certain. And they said, no. The point is, we all do this. You know, it's not about heavens and earth, and it's about all the things we blame our deterministic life on. No, sorry, it's you. But the beauty of this is, again, is the realization of Shah Achas, of the realization of how much one moment can count. So says Rabbi Chaim Shon Emetz, he says, that means to say, a person could go through life and have many Shahs. We could have many comments. We could hear many Rabbi Yosef ben Ezer saying these things. We could hear many Zoinoists saying these statements. And we sort of brush it off, you know, haha, you know, that's that, you know, or maybe even think about it seriously for half a minute and carry on moving on through our lives. But we missed that. That was our Shah Achas, meaning there were many Elazar ben Dodaias, and they all heard these kind of statements through their lives. There were many times where they had these junctions, and they just missed it. They didn't get there. The responsibility of the moment, like the responsibility of Bnei Yisrael when they were in the moment of vulnerability to learn from it, what it means to be a bondsman and not never do that to somebody else, like Paltim ben Laish, that's a responsible moment. And listen to what Racham Shlevitz says at this moment. He says, that's why it says, Vayishma Yisrael, Mashmo Shamova, Kriyas Yamsuf. He says the following. He says, everybody else heard that moment too. It was broadcasted. Everybody knew about that, right? Everybody in the Middle East knew about that. He was the only person who really heard it. And in fact, he goes on, I checked the diyot, because this is in the Maimer in Lamed Aleph, is given in Tafshin Lamed Aleph, 1971. So this is what he says. I'm going to quote actually the word for word. He says, V'chein ro'inu b'inyoneinu, b'ineinu, Es hayis oirus hagdoilo she'achsa bekulonu be'eis ha'atzala b'milchema b'milchama ha'achrona. We all saw the inspiration of the salvation of the last war, referring to the Six-Day War, 1967. This was just a short 3 and a bit years before. Ach me'ach she'leid yodano le'natzla u'le'shomra k'mosh tzorich. We didn't fully utilize that experience. Nishara kol kufi shaya. We now returned. We're back to the way it used to be. Right? You know, they tell a story about the lady who's walking along the coast, and she's walking with her son. A huge wave comes, a shock wave, riptide pulls the boy out. She's frantic, she doesn't know what to do. She's not a particularly religious lady, so she says, God, I haven't been a good Jew, but please, if you return my son like he is, Shabbos candles, kashrus, kosher, I'll do, God, and she's crying, she's begging, she's saying any psalm she knows, and boom, the wave comes. Right at her feet, her son lands on other things, coughs up a few mouthfuls of water, and he's breathing. And it's remarkable, and everybody's looking, this is supernatural, how did this happen? And after a few moments, she says, but he had a hat. Like, that's what happens, right? Milchema Sheshes Yomim, it was supernatural. Says, yeah, it's all right. You know, look, our intelligence, you watch this, there's a history channel. If you watch the history channel, it's an explanation of the Six-Day War. You know, the Israelis were, militarily superior. They used to drive their jeeps with half the air in the jeeps. They had more surface. They would make sure to hydrate their men. They used to have 8 liters of water a day. The Egyptians had no idea about this. We have millions of explanations. You know, 2020 hindsight. Let's be honest. It was all a miracle, right? And that's what he says. The way to guard those moments, those shah achases in our lives, he al yedei sheyazkir laatzmoi tamid zahergesh shaya b'liboy az. To remember that moment of inspiration when we hear it, ukinyan naatz cherev, but to draw the sword, to stick the sword of objectivity into set our compasses, because she is called harega utamid. When you see that reminder of that moment, v'yishmar b'liboy sashah achas yuchal liknois al yodai salama. Then you could. There's a poem for those who are interested in literature, called one of our favorite poems of all times, called The Love Poem of Sir Alfred J. Prufrock. It's actually written by T.S. Eliot. T.S. Eliot is a very complex writer, but this is actually a much more understandable poem. It's about this English gentleman, and he's talking about the complexities of the English society, and it's about this. He's growing older, and he's talking about how he really admires a particular lady, and he's wondering, do I dare? Do I dare ask her out? Do I dare talk to her about my feelings about her? And the refrain keeps on being is, do I dare, do I dare? And basically, at the end of the poem, he concludes, there'll be more times. And he basically carries on with his, simple mediocrity and path of least resistance. And I feel like sometimes what he's saying is that we have those moments and the window's open, but we don't dare. We just let it keep going and we miss it. So this is perhaps some ideas which are familiar, but other ideas which I think he digs deep into, not just the experience, but also the responsibility by experience. Anyways, very, very powerful.
So how is it possible, after Matan Torah, 40 days later, all of Klal Yisrael had amnesia almost.
You're right.
I mean, how is that?
Now, I don't know if all of Klal Yisrael first, but he had a hat. Meaning, that's what happens. We have these experiences. You go to see a mashas and you're like, oh my goodness, that's so overwhelming. And I'm gonna do daf yom. I'm gonna do 2 daf a day. And you get out there and then life happens again. It's very, very hard to understand. But at the same time, the Chet HaEgel is a little more complex. There was something they were trying to do. Mirza Shem Kisisa, hopefully we'll see some of his thoughts. But anyways, his thoughts.
All Jewish history has this trend.
Yes,
almost. I mean,
sure.
One of the most famous stories, Eliyahu ben Harkarmel.
Yeah, sure.
The next day,
that's what it is. Yeah,
right? It's amazing.
Listen, I don't think it's everybody, but it's.
I think we have Yom Kippur, then comes Maariv, and we're rushing through Maariv.